Srila Prabhupada's translation. Education, charity, penance, and truth are said to be the four legs of religion. Is that interesting? Is that interesting? What do we usually say are the four legs of religion? Yes. So instead of mercy and cleanliness, we're getting what? And charity. Education, charity, penance, and truth are said to be the four legs of religion. And to learn this religion, there are four spiritual orders of life, along with different classifications of castes according to vocation. Brahma created all these in systematic order. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The nucleus of the four spiritual orders, brahmacharya or student life, grihastha or household or family life, vanaprastha or retired life for practicing penance, and sannyasa or renounced life for preaching the truth, consists of the four legs of religion. Right? So what's going to go with what? Yes. Did everybody hear that? The vocational divisions are the brahmanas, or the intelligent class, the kshatriyas, or the administrative class. Now, people often hear administrative, and they think that means anyone who manages anything. But Prabhupada's talking about government, societal administration. He's not talking about that if you manage a bakery that you're a kshatriya. Well, people think like that. Just like, you know, Nanda Maharaj. We even call him King Nanda. But is he a kshatriya? No. Okay. So people often think that. As soon as you're administering anything, then. But no, it's talking about societal administration, not any kind of management. The Vaishyas, the mercantile productive class, and the Shudras, or general labor class, who have no specific qualifications. All were systematically planned and created by Brahma for the regular promotion of self-realization. So that's the purpose of all of these. Student life is meant for acquiring the best education. Household life, household family life is meant for gratifying the senses, provided it is performed with a charitable disposition of mind. Retirement from household life is meant for penance, for advancement in spiritual life. And renounced life is meant for preaching the absolute truth to the people in general. The combined actions of all members of society make the whole situation favorable for the fulfillment of the mission of human life. So what's the purpose of these ashrams and varnas? Is to facilitate spiritual life. The beginning of this social institution is based on education, meant for purifying the human being of the animal propensities. The highest purificatory process is knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the purest of the pure. Vidya dhanam tata satyam dharmasyeti padani cha ashramas cha yata sankhyam ashrajat saha vritti bhi. Education, charity, penance, and truth are said to be the four legs of religion, and to learn this religion, there are four spiritual orders of life, along with different classifications of castes according to vocation. Brahma created all these in systematic order. So if you ask people in general, what do you want? What are your main questions about life? Or even what is the purpose of life? Srila Prabhupada was asked in South America, what is the purpose of life? Do you know what he answered? Happiness. Yes, he said, Ananda, the purpose of life is to be happy. I remember I was 14. And I was babysitting. I had a summer job being like a nanny to these kids. And they were living with their grandparents. Their grandparents were out. The kids were sleeping. And I had nothing to do. There was no internet box in my pocket in those days. I think I probably had a book with me. But I was thinking, what's the purpose of life? What's the purpose of life? And I decided that the purpose of life was Ananda. The purpose of life is to be happy. And then I asked a very funny question. I said, am I happy? Now, folks, if you have to ask that question, immediately you can understand that you're not happy. Like, am I happy? And then I wrote down a list of things, really, that was kind of like a gratitude list. You know, what facility I had in my family, or that I was a good student in school, and that kind of things, that I had friends. And I looked at this list, and I said, oh, I must be happy. I have all these things. I must be happy. People don't know how to be happy, how to find meaning and purpose in their lives. So what is given from Lord Brahma, we talked about this the other day as well, it's holistic. He's giving the science of how to be happy holistically, how to find ultimate happiness, and how to have a support for ultimate happiness that also helps you to be happy on the way to finding ultimate happiness. That not that while you're becoming ultimately happy, you're just suffering. You know, we read in the Bhagavad Gita, Dukkhalayam Ashasvatam. Alayam means a place. Dukkha means misery. So I heard from Chaitanya Charan Prabhu one time in class that I thought was very insightful. He says, Himalaya. Alaya, you can have a place. And Hima means what? Ice or cold. The place where it's cold. But are the Himalayas only a place where it's cold? Can you say anything else about the Himalayas other than just cold? If it was just cold, then you might be talking about a walk-in freezer. Do you follow? So the Himalayas are also what? Desolate. What else? Beautiful. They're majestic. We don't feel inspired just looking at a picture of a walk-in freezer. Anybody feel very inspired? When anybody put a photograph of a walk-in freezer, you know, on there, or a big picture just of an ice cube on their wall. But people are going to put photographs or paintings of the Himalayas on their wall, correct? Yes? Well, coldness is not the only feature. And then, of course, if one works in this world in a specific way, one actually doesn't experience the dukkha. We do not have a philosophy of just suffer, 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 suffer in life, and if you do the right things, you'll go to heaven where you'll enjoy. Is that our philosophy? I hope not. I hope not. You know, we have tapaha is one of the elements, but tapaha should be also, ironically, enjoyable. Prabhupada talks about in Brahmacharya Ashram how the children should get pleasure from their austerities. Don't we all have austerities which give us pleasure? Correct? Well, if you think about what kind of austerities give us pleasure, you'll see it's when there's dharma. This is talking about the four legs of dharma. And the essence of dharma is to... What's the essence of dharma? To serve. The essence of dharma is to serve. When we do austerities to serve, and especially if we're serving someone or something that we love that inspires us, those austerities do not feel painful. Prabhupada talks about the burden of the young husband on the young wife, the burden of the child in the lap of the parent. Those do not feel like austerities. In fact, I often give the example, any of you who've ever dealt with very young babies, if they're happy or they're sleeping, not if they're screaming, but if they're happy or sleeping and they're on your chest and you're like rocking them in a rocking chair or just sitting, it's one of the most pleasurable experiences that anybody can experience. It's just an austerity. You're stuck in the chair holding the baby, you know, and there's some weight of the child. But it's a great pleasure. People try to do this with pets. You know, they're hugging their animal and feeling this pleasure of love. It's a pleasure of love. You understand? Right? You're going through a great deal of pleasure to have a surprise birthday party for someone you love. Does it feel like an austerity? No. And we experience this in devotional service. We're doing some huge festival. I mean, the Janmashtami here is probably one of the most intense Janmashtamis of any ISKCON center in the world. And it's a whole month of austerity for 1,000 volunteers. But people are feeling happy. Yes, so this Dukkhalayam, Shasvatam, it's only for those who have the wrong consciousness. If you have the consciousness of trying to enjoy the world, then it's a place of misery. And Prabhupada writes this in Krishna Book, Chapter 20. He said, for the materialists, they see the world as very aggressive, but the devotees see that everything is happily situated. And when I quote this to people, people have said to me, Urmila, you must be misquoting this. The non-devotees think they're happy, and the devotees think that everything is aggressive and miserable. And I'm saying, then why do you want to be a devotee? So Lord Brahma is creating a system by which not only do you achieve ultimate happiness, but even in this world, in the process of achieving ultimate happiness, you also feel happy. Does not Krishna say this in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita? That he's created this system of yajna for, anybody remember? Yes, to live happily in this world and achieve liberation. So how is Krishna talking about living happily in a place of misery? Because we don't see it that way. Now, we touched upon this the other day, that most ideologies and systems are not fully holistic. They tend to look either at trying to be happy in this world or trying to achieve liberation, bhakti or mukti, yeah? So most religions, most spiritualities, most ideologies of the world, either they're focused on how can you make this material world a happy place, or forget about making the material world a happy place, just get out of here and have salvation. We were talking about world-affirming and world-denying religions. And that we are what? Both. We're worshiping Sita Ram, Lakshman, Hanuman. It says that when Ram was ruling the world, that the miseries decreased for everyone, correct? That when you have a God-centered society, that there's still adiatmic, adidaivic, adibhotic, but you're not identifying with them and you're not experiencing them as miseries. So here we find ultimately the Vedas are bringing us to our spiritual relationship with the Lord, to ultimate happiness. Any plan for material happiness that doesn't include that will not bring people actual happiness. You're not going to get ultimate happiness just by loving your baby. It's not going to do it. Because then your baby will also cry and your baby will also poop on you and that kind of thing. Or your baby may grow up to not want to talk to you anymore. So if you're only trying to adjust the material energy, how can I make a lot of money? How can I have perfect relationships with others? How can I keep healthy? And you don't focus on the ultimate goal of life, then even in this world, you're not going to be very happy. So first we look at that Vedic wisdom brings us beyond this world. Then Vedic wisdom also gives us details of how we maintain. This verse is vritti. Vritti is how you maintain yourself. And also Vedic wisdom gives a system of purification that synchronizes with our natural biological progression and cycles. So Vedic wisdom brings us beyond this material world through a process of yajna. So we had in verse 40, there was a list of all these yajnas, which I must confess, I don't know what most of them are. Do any of you know what these are? I mean, we had this whole list. What was it? All these different yajnas. We had Shodasi, Utka, Porisi, Agnistoma, Aptoryama, Atiratra, Rajapeya, Gosava. Anybody in here know what any of those are? Anybody? Okay. I don't feel so bad that I don't know what they are. So there's obviously a lot of yajnas. Now, Srila Prabhupada uses the word sacrifice as a translation for the word yajna. Of course, the English word sacrifice usually implies some kind of pain. It usually, we think of giving up something you don't want to give up, maybe for a higher purpose. If we look about the essence of yajna, they're all some sort of rituals, correct? They're all some kind. Now, the word ritual in 2025 can have a negative connotation in relationship to religion. It doesn't have a totally negative connotation, like if I say, what's a good morning ritual? Or what rituals do you do to make sure that you get exercise or something like that? But in the context of religion, if we talk about religious rituals, people usually think of that as something meaningless, something mechanical that you don't know why you're doing. I mean, when I was a child, the way I was brought up, we had a lot of rituals and no one knew what we were doing. Like we would light candles once a week and then we would take the flame and we put our hand over the flame and touch our hand to our head. And I'd say, what's the purpose of this? And nobody had any idea. Or we would take bread and we'd put it on a beautiful tray and cover it with a cloth. And then we'd take the cloth off and we'd hold it up in the air and we'd say blessings over the bread. And then everybody would take a piece of it. And I'd say, why are we doing this? No, I don't know. It's just what we do. So people think about religious rituals like that. So I personally prefer the word ceremonies because I feel like ceremonies doesn't have that much of a connotation. And it also has some idea of maybe something celebratory. So yajna is supposed to be something celebratory, a ceremony of celebration of our connection with God. How do I connect with God? How do I connect with Krishna? That's what a yajna is about. And of course, the Vedas also have yajnas for those connecting with the various gods, the various demigods. And that, yes, there's a certain ritual to most of these yajnas. Just like I give the example, you know, if I want to call my son, I have to do a ceremony, I have to do a ritual. So I have to have a phone. The phone has to be on a network. The phone has to be charged. I have to know his number. I have to put the number in exactly one number off. It's not going to work. And the timing has to be good. So right now, it's probably like 2 o'clock in the morning or something there. Hopefully he's sleeping. And if I called him, he'd be annoyed. I wouldn't actually connect. You follow? Either I would get voicemail or I'd get an annoyed voice on the other end. Mata, why are you calling me at 2 o'clock in the morning? So most of these yajnas are like that. Most of these yajnas are very specific. You have to chant certain mantras. You have to chant them in a very specific way. Or instead of getting somebody who's going to kill Indra, you get someone who Indra kills. Instead of getting a son, you get a daughter. Things get, you know these stories, right? So they usually, the mantras have to be chanted. They have to be done at a certain time. A lot of these yajnas, you do them at the wrong time and it's messed up. Right? Any little deviation and all the ceremonies have to be done properly. So at the Shraddha ceremony for my grandson who died in a vehicle accident, they were doing this Shraddha ceremony and I was looking at the priest and he had all these, this was in Seattle, Washington State, and the northwest part of the United States, climate very much like here in London, and he was using all of these ingredients from the tropics. He was using like coconuts and all this stuff. And all of a sudden I thought that originally all of these ingredients, they must have had some subtle power. You know, these yajnas the brahmanas did in ancient time, they had power. You put an old horse in the fire and you see in the fire a colt comes out. And the brahmanas could go to you, you know, become an elephant. And then in front of everybody's eyes, you became an elephant. And I thought all these things that he's doing, they probably were imbued with subtle powers. Practically what we would call magic, you know. And I was thinking, I bet you they're not anymore. And I was thinking, I wonder if there's ingredients here in this location that could also have those subtle powers if you knew how to use them. And then I was thinking, is this ritual he's doing, is it doing anything? Is it efficacious? You know, the idea is it's supposed to help the soul go on to a higher realm. And I thought, is it actually doing anything? And then I thought, well, it's in front of the deities. and he's including the holy name. So that's really what's happening. That's what's efficacious. But most likely all of his specific ceremonies and his ingredients were probably impotent. But these yagyas have this kind of purpose. So knowledge of yagyas, how you can connect, what ceremonies you can do to connect with the divine. And also Brahma's giving us theology. Knowledge that I'm a soul, knowledge of my relationship with the Lord. I was just hearing this morning Prabhupada's introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, that in order to hear the Bhagavad Gita, we have to be established in a relationship with the Lord. And he talks about the five rasas. So knowledge of what is our eternal relationship with the Lord. And Prabhupada was saying there very clearly that we all have our own intrinsic eternal relationship with the Lord that has to be awakened. And then processes of personal ceremonies of connection, our individual spiritual practice, what we call our sadhana. So all of this knowledge is given in the Vedas for achieving the higher things of life and ultimately how to make everything a ceremony of connection. Okay, but then what about my vrittihi? What about how I maintain my life in this world? One devotee a couple days ago said to me, he said, it just seems like my life is like, get up, get my 16 rounds done as fast as possible, do my puja as fast as possible, and get out and go to work. Is this really my life? Is this the kind of life that I want? So Lord Brahma is also giving the instructions how to work in a spiritual consciousness with the four varnas. The word varna is an interesting word. It means color. It also can mean choice. What is my choice? What is my desire? What is my nature? How do I want to, if we have varna dharma, it would be how do I want to? What is our dharma to? How do I choose to serve? How do I choose to serve? We often use that kind of terminology for people in the military. Oh, someone's going into the service. If we say, oh, how's your kid doing? Oh, he joined the service. Right? That means they went into the military. And people in the military, we say, thank you for your service. Because we understand that no one's going to do that except in service. It has to be in service to some ideology, to some conception. Yeah? But actually, all of the varnas have this concept of service. So one devotee, who I respect very much, so I won't say his name, posted this thing that if you want to find out what is your dharma, find out what you like and what you're good at. So I wrote to him privately, and I said, that's not going to work, Prabhu. Because Krishna says twice in the Gita, in the 3rd and the 18th chapter, you can be very good at things that are not your dharma. He says, don't do things you're very good at that aren't your dharma. We can learn to be good at things for all sorts of reasons. Maybe it was our parents' occupation. Maybe everyone in our society told us to do that. And so maybe we even got a master's degree in it, and we're expert at the skills of it. But it's not how we would choose to serve. And then you can say, well, do what you love. But what a person loves may be what they love for recreation. Like when we were counseling someone in their Varna Dharma, and they were talking about how they love to be in nature. And then we said, well, would you like to have a job that puts you out in nature? And immediately she says, no, that's what I want to do when I get away from my work. I go in nature to rejuvenate myself. So Krishna distinguishes in the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita between work and recreation. Right? A person for recreation might like to, you know, get out their guitar and sing bhajans in their room, but that doesn't mean they want to go on stage with the guitar and have people pay them money for being a musician. Now, if you're doing your dharma, you will find that getting good at it comes very naturally to you. That doesn't mean there's no work involved, but it means getting good at it will come naturally to you, and it means you're also going to find your pleasure there. but you're going to find your pleasure there in service. You're going to find your pleasure there in service. So what are the different ways that the four varnas offer service? So the Brahmana varna offers service by giving what to the world? Knowledge, truth, and wisdom. And in order to do that, the Brahmanas have to be very what? Studied. They have to know truth. You can't give truth if you don't know it. And they also have to be very what? Detached. Because truth has to be objective. If I'm going to skew truth according to what people want to hear, that's not going to be useful. That's why we distinguish between journalism and advertisement. Correct? Does anyone expect an advertisement to be truthful? No. You know, and usually in the newspapers, they'll have at least a little note, advertisement. Right? Of course, they try to make that as small as possible and gray out the scale many times so that you really have to look and see, is this an advertisement? You know, formerly in the newspapers, they would keep the marketing department on a different floor than the journalism department and sometimes have even different elevators, different lifts, so that there wouldn't be a mixture, so that the journalists wouldn't be skewed by what do the advertisers want to have in the newspaper. Sometimes Brahmanas would live apart from the rest of society out in the forest. So they weren't even interacting with society. Right? So this objectivity and to be willing to sacrifice themselves for objective truth, even if it means that they're persecuted, even if that means that they're jailed, even if it means that they're tortured. Do we see this in history? People who speak objective religious truth or objective scientific truth that's not so much in line with the prevailing ideologies. They often get jailed or tortured or persecuted. Prabhupada talks about how traditionally the Brahmanas were expert in Ayurveda and in astrology. And they would go door to door. And he said, everybody wants to know about their future. So you go to a door. Would you like to know your future? Sure. Yes, of course. So they would tell the person's future. And then they'd say, are there any health problems here? And then they'd help with that. And then people will train to give the Brahmanas some donation. And in the course of giving that astrological knowledge and Ayurvedic knowledge, they would also impart higher knowledge about yajna. They would use people's interest in that to also bring them to the divine. And so the Brahmanas had this idea, I'm doing this in service, not just to the people, but in service to God, in service to Krishna. Definitely. And then you have the Kshatriyas. So what is their service for society? Protection of society. Prabhupada used the term peace and prosperity 195 times, that exact phrase, peace and prosperity. And I'm sure if we did a deep dive to the variations on that, we'd find hundreds and hundreds more. If society is not peaceful and prosperous, it's very hard to hear truth and wisdom. Like when I teach classes, I try to make sure. Now I knew the window was going to be open, so I kept my chatter on. But I try to make sure that the temperature in the room is not going to be too hot or too cold. You try to make sure that people have something to eat if it's going to be a long time and not cow food. Sorry, it's a little... You try to make sure that people have the facility that they need. They have a comfortable place to sit. That they're not going to be too tired. Because otherwise, Prabhupada said, if people are hungry, they can't hear the truth. First, you have to feed them. You know, if there's wars going on, are people going to sit and listen to philosophy if there's bombs falling? No, I don't think so. Or if there's too much crime. You know, if there's rampant crime, if there's bombs falling, if people don't have their basic, as Prabhupada would say, basic necessities of life, and you want to sit and talk to them about, you know, you're not this body and there's a God, they're so distracted by having to take care of things that they can't do it. So without this protection, you're not going to have higher wisdom. And protection, it doesn't mean that every single kshatriya is walking around with a bow and arrow and a sword. You know, many, but not everybody. So there are also people who are making the laws, enforcing the laws, making sure people get the benefit of the laws, making sure that the housing is up to the standard of people going into the housing and inspecting the housing. Is this in compliance with the law? Is it safe in terms of fire? Is the food safe? There's so many realms of protection. And what's driving the kshatriyas is they're looking for what? What's their driver? Honor, dignity. They want everyone to be treated with dignity and honor. And justice and morals and ethics and fairness. And again, they're willing to sacrifice themselves for that. They're willing to sacrifice their life, their health, their functionality. And why are they doing this? To serve who? To serve who? The Lord, who comes as the supreme kshatriya, right there on the altar. And even Krishna, I mean, Krishna, of course, appears in a Vaishya family, but he also comes as a kshatriya to give protection. And those who are doing that as the agents of the Lord. Then the Vaishyas, what are they providing for society? Food. And merchandise. They're providing all the raw materials. They're providing the food in its raw form. They're providing the fibers, the cotton, the flax, the wool. They're providing the construction materials, the lumber, the bricks, the metals. They're providing all the raw materials for medicine, all the herbs, everything that we need in life. They're the only ones who are providing the materials for everything. The kshatriyas are redistributing them, collecting wealth and taxes that they're redistributing. The Brahmins are collecting charity and redistributing charity. But only the Vaishyas are actually generating. And what's driving them? Expanding wealth in a sustainable, regenerative way. The Bhagavatam says that those in this varna are always thirsty. Literally, that's what it says. They're not satisfied people. The Brahmanas are satisfied people. If they get a little khichdi, a place to lie down, they're satisfied. They want to make sure people follow Dharma. That's something else. But the kshatriyas and the vaishyas, they're not satisfied. The kshatriyas want to protect more people. The vaishyas want to create more food. They're not going to just grow a little garden in their backyard. They want to make sure that there's enough food, clothing, everything, but in a sustainable way. And they're willing to sacrifice themselves for that, to make sure that things are sustainable. And the Shudras, what do they give to society? Beauty, support, functionality. They make everything work. That we have lights. That's from Shudra work. I was once in a temple where everyone was a Brahmana, and so everything was broken. Prabhupada said, we're trying to have a temple, so we don't want just Brahmanas who are going to go around just saying, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. We need people who are going to do things. Without the Shudras, nothing works. And nothing is beautiful. Why do people come to Bhaktivedanta Manor? Do they come here just for the wisdom? Do they? They also come because this place is very what? Beautiful. Who does that? What kind of work is that? All the landscaping, all the cleaning, all that maintenance. I have been to ugly temples where nobody pulls the weeds, nobody takes out the trash. I've been to temples like this. Been to temples where right by the front door is overflowing rubbish bin. Like, okay. A lot of people come here just because it's very beautiful. Let's go to a park and sit by the water and see the ducks and be among the flowers. And then they also get spiritual benefit. The Vaishyas are wanting to expand wealth ultimately to please who? Krishna. Does Krishna want everyone to be fed? Yes. And the Shudras are making the world work and beautiful and being supportive to please who? Krishna. They're saying this is Krishna's garden, and that's not just at the temple. Anywhere they're saying. Prabhupada would turn off dripping faucets in random people's yards. He didn't say, well, that's just some random karmi. Who cares if they're wasting water? He said, that's Krishna's water. So they see the world as the body of God. And what are the sutras? What if they're dharmic, if they're actually working for the Lord, what are they willing to sacrifice for? The quality, integrity of their craft or their service. If someone says to them, instead of doing stone carving, and this is my personal experience, instead of doing stone carving, just pour fiberglass, mix fiberglass with concrete into molds and make it look like stone carving, and it'll be cheaper and faster, a dharmic shudra is going to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to pollute the whole shudra varna. Sorry, not going to agree to this. We're going to keep the craft. So this is how one is moved in service. And are any of these varnas more spiritual than the other? Prabhupada would say, of course, here you have a tile floor, but in many temples we have a marble floor. And Prabhupada would say, whether you're cleaning the marble floor or you're bathing the marble deity, it's the same. The floor is also part of the body of God. That Krishna doesn't distinguish like this. In Mathura, Krishna and Balaram go to the florist and the tailor and say, you will have all happiness and prosperity in this world and you will go back to Godhead. He didn't say, oh, you're just a Shudra. So however, whatever is our innate dharma, however we're moved like that, that should be our source of livelihood. The first basic aspect of Varna Dharma is that however we are moved intrinsically to serve should be the way that we maintain ourselves. Then we're looking at the four ashramas. So the four ashramas are part of our natural biological system. Am I doing better with the mic? I'm really trying to be super conscious. So if you have a normal lifespan, you're going to first be a child. Right? Then you're going to be in full youth. Then you're going to hit middle age. And then you're going to hit old age, right? If you have a normal lifespan, typically. And the psychology for each of these stages of life is different. The physiology is different. The psychology is different. Even the brain works differently. The brains of young children work differently. They have different predominant wavelengths than in adulthood. So there's a system by which our natural changes in physiology and psychology and inclinations can be linked to yajna. Again, that the core of everything is yajna. The core of everything is having these ceremonies of connection with the divine. And then doing that through our work, according to our nature, and then doing it in our life according to our natural changes of life. So the first one, which Prabhupada gives the most emphasis to in this verse, is the time of education. Something I bring up a lot is that in 1976, Prabhupada was talking about the verses from the seventh canto on the Brahmachari Ashram. And he was going back and forth between the Brahmachari Ashram and the temple for adults and the Gurukul school for children. He was equating them. So our Brahmachari, Brahmacharini ashrams should be places for? No. Education. They should be places for it. Now, Bhaktivedanta Manor, it does a lot of education in the ashrams. Compared to most Brahmachari, Brahmacharini ashrams I see, there's a lot of emphasis on education. Like I notice in the ladies' ashram here, I've noticed this over the years. Do you still have like that three-month course where people come and they come to study for 3 months? Or this concept of the Be a Monk Challenge. Come and get some education. Okay, so now that I've finished praising you, now I'm going to challenge you. And hopefully I'll be invited back after I challenge you. So generally the education we give in our temple ashrams is just in yajna and sadhana. But Prabhupada says in the second canto that the Brahmachari ashram is also meant to give specific training for a livelihood. And Prabhupada wanted Varnashram colleges in every center. So our ashramas should be a place for training in Varna. And a devotee just sent me a quote yesterday that from the fourth canto about Dhruva Maharaj, that unless one is trained in their tendency, they cannot fully exhibit their varna. We have to be trained in our dharma. Okay, you have the natural tendency to be a Vaishya. How to be trained in your dharma? You have a natural tendency to be a Shudra. How to be trained in your dharma? And this should be happening in our Brahmacharini, Brahmacharini ashrams. Please don't shoot the messenger. And training in ashram. We know very well that the majority of people who stay in our Brahmacharini, Brahmachari ashrams are going to become grihasthas. That's normal. That's natural. There's only a tiny percentage of people who are going to stay renunciates their whole life. That's normal. Yes? Yeah, okay. So we should also be training them for their future as grihasthas. How to be a good husband, how to be a good wife, how to be a good parent. How to be, what here was the essence of grihastha life? What was the word? Charity. How to be charitable. What does it mean to be charitable? How to be charitable not just with your money, but with your time, with your talents. How to give in service. Often people come and say, I want to do service. And the only thing we have for them to do is scrubbing pots. I mean, scrubbing pots is good. But that shouldn't be the only way that people have to volunteer. Here again, at Bhaktivedanta Manor, you have so many different things going on here that there's often a wide range of volunteer service people can do. But in many temples, it's just like, I want to do some service. You can clean the floor. So to teach people how to be charitable, how to have a God-centered home, how to have the ashram connected with the Lord. And also, some people in the Brahmachari, Brahmacharini ashrams are not going to become grihasthas. They're going to stay lifetime renunciates. But still, most of them, of those people should graduate from the Brahmachari ashram, which is a school meant for young people. The seventh canto says the brahmacharis can go to become grihasthas, vanaprasthas, or sannyasis. And I see that many of our people who remain as renunciates go from the brahmachari ashram to the vanaprastha ashram. They often travel and they become preachers. They're not just in school. They're not just under strict discipline in a school. They've become adults. Now, in most temples, we have some people who psychologically stay students. They don't really become preachers. They just do some menial service in a temple their whole life. It's probably useful in most temples to have a few people like this. But that shouldn't be our ideal, that if you want to be the ideal Krishna conscious person, you just stay in a temple your whole life as if you're still a child. And have two tracks in our ashram. Training for the grahastha ashram, training for the vanaprastha ashram. And to do that before people get burned out at staying in the brahmacharya ashram. To do that before people exceed their time in school. Yes? And that should be our main education. To have the brahmacharya ashrams be a place of education. To be a place of training. And I've been talking about this for years. There was one devotee running a brahmacharya ashram in one place. He himself had become inspired in this way, and he had started to develop a whole curriculum. He shared it with me. We're discussing it over a few weeks, and we're working on it. And then he writes back and says, oh, the managers nixed the whole thing. They don't want our ashrams to be a place of training and education. Sheesh. And then training, of course, in the grahastha ashram, how to be charitable, how to work according to your varna, how to link everything in service, and training for vanaprastas. We're starting to see this training for vanaprastas happen in our society. Jayadori Tomaris is writing a book on the vanaprastha ashram. We're starting to see people understand, how do I become vanaprastas? One thing we are doing in our movement is training for sannyasis. So we've started to have programs to train sannyasis in preparation for sannyas and during sannyas, with all this idea of connection with Krishna. So what I'd like to ask all of us to think about individually and for society, how can I go forward in the area of connection with Krishna? How can I go forward in the area of yajna? How can I connect more of my daily life with Krishna? How can we go forward in the area of varna for myself as an individual? How can I discover my nature and use it in service? How can I start to develop the society to go in that direction? And how can we move forward in the area of ashram dharma? How can I work with my own ashram dharma, whether I'm a brahmachari, brahmacharini, grahastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas? How can I connect that with the Lord? And how can I help develop that ashram dharma within our society? So I've gone 3 minutes over. Any questions, comments, corrections? Chastisements. Yes.
Thank you for class, Mother Vila. The word Brahminical culture, in one sense you're describing it, and what exactly does that mean compared to
the Brahmana Varna?
Yes.
So I understand this in several ways, Brahminical culture. First of all, Prabhupada gave us four regulative principles that traditionally were associated just with the Brahmana Varna. The other three Varnas had somewhat modifications of those. I really became aware of that in Bali, where people are regularly eating meat. The Hindus are eating meat, even beef. And you'll say, why are you eating meat? And they say, vegetarianism is just for the Brahmanas. Which I found very interesting. So Srila Prabhupada's given a Brahminical standard for everybody. And I understand the reason he's done this is because Kali Yuga enters through those four sinful activities. And the only way we're going to connect with Krishna is if we're not so much affected by Kali Yuga. So regardless of your varna, you need to have that kind of those four principles. You know, you're not going to be able to chant Hare Krishna and connect with Krishna very well if you drink alcohol and eat meat and like that. I mean, I know Prabhupada said even the alcoholics can find Krishna in the taste of their wine, but eventually they're going to have to give that up. The other way in which I understand Brahminical culture is to have a culture in general that supports the Brahminical varna, both practically and psychologically, because Brahminical work is generally seen by the rest of society as
laziness
and uselessness. A lot of Brahminical work is seen as impractical and useless. When I was working on the Learn to Read curriculum, I started here at the manor, actually, And I asked a number of places, can you maintain me while I work on international curriculum? And the manor management said, for 3 months. You can stay for three. And their policy was, they said, 3 months a year. You can stay here and just, I don't think they do that anymore. I think they've jettisoned that. But it was 3 months a year, you can stay and work on international projects. You remember, I used to come here, right? For a month or two and do that. And then one other temple said, well, you can stay, but you have to share an office with 10 people. And then, you know, another place said you can stay for a month. And there was only one place that said you can actually just stay as long as you want. No local requirements put on you, and you can just work on this. So that's a lack of Brahminical culture. You know, and I understand temples have practical requirements and a limited number of rooms and that kind of, I understand that. But if you just think about it, you know, if you went to most places and said, I want to spend a year to write about the difference, or just to study the difference between the poetry of Srila Rupa Goswami and Srila Krishnadas Kaviraj, will you feed me and house me? Most places will say, sorry, we can't facilitate something like that. And to know that the brahmanas have to be maintained, because brahmanas by nature are not money-minded. They're just not. And in fact, they can even get so absorbed in intellectual work that they forget about their bodily needs. So somebody has to be thinking about that for them. So a Brahminical culture is a culture that, on a practical level, supports people doing Brahminical work, and on a psychological level, supports the importance of Brahminical work. Does that make sense? Because without the theoretical study, you can't do the practical stuff. But the theoretical study in and of itself does not appear to be practical. Does that make sense to everybody? Yes? So that's my understanding. All right. We could take one more, and then... Oh, we'll take two more. I'll take one. Right. Yes?
Yeah. I meet lots of young people. They speak to me because they find it easy to communicate with me.
Oh, yes.
And one thing that they're frustrated about is not knowing their Varna.
Yes.
Right here at the center. And so I talk with people from different backgrounds. And I know you're here to do something about that. I heard sometime last week.
That's the rumor, yep.
Oh, the rumor, right. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, is this something that you planned for other centers in ISKCON? Or is
yes.
it just... Okay.
Yes, mm-hmm. is a simple answer. Mm. Do you want to know the whole plan?
Well, I would love to hear it.
Well, I'll see if I can make it very, very fast. So we worked for 6 years, myself and Dr. Ruchira Datta, to write a book, Career Dharma, about Varna Dharma, with thorough research. We've been teaching it all over the world. We developed an online course that people can hook up with. We have plans for a simplified version. We have plans for a super simplified version to go into the schools in Azerbaijan under Swayam Bhagavan Keshav Maharaj. Azerbaijan. Okay, thank you. Azerbaijan. I have the emphasis on bai. Okay. One of those words you look at like, how do I say that? And then we're also, what we just completed here was certifying people who can actually help people discover what their Varna is, to become coaches in that. And that really is a step towards creating a Varnashram college, because before you can train someone in their Varna, they have to know what it is. And it's not like you say to people, you're this, you're this, you're this, but you, the science of self-realization, you help them to realize their self. So, yes, Jayanti? We're past time, so if you want to leave, it's fine.
Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, thank you so much for your beautiful class. I always have problem with the varnas, specifically because in Kali we are in mixed varnas, like Varna Sankara, most of us. So how this... we have different...
It's funny, I went to look that up and I couldn't find it. So I'm really wondering if it's one of these ISKCON legends.
Couldn't find the Varna Sankara?
Well, the first Varna Sankara can mean mixed by birth. You know, in ancient times, or not that ancient, people were very careful to marry someone of the same varna, and then they knew these rituals by which they could have a child of the same varna.
Is it
that doesn't work now? So your parents are probably of two different varnas, and they didn't know the rituals to have you. So we know, it used to be children could be trained in their occupation from a very young age. You had good astrologers who could look at the chart and say, okay, I know what this person's varna is, and their parents were that varna, and they did the rituals. And so most people had the same varna as their family. That's no longer operative. The astrologers today aren't that good. People don't know the rituals, or the rituals have no efficacy. People are from different. So our process for finding our varna now has to be a little bit different. But I don't see that anybody's in a mixed varna. I don't see how you could be in a mixed varna. I don't see how it's possible. And actually in this fourth canto purport, Prabhupada was indirectly saying like that, that the varnas have, they have mutually contradictory dharmas. You can't be a mutually contradictory person. You wouldn't be able to function. You'd be at a war with yourself.
A lot of people.
Well, a lot of people are confused.
Yeah, confused.
So a lot of people are very confused. Yeah. But your actual nature is not confused. You're confused about your nature, but the nature itself is not confused. Yes. Trying to be in a mixed varna, or let's say sannyasi and grihastha at the same time. Yes, if we were trying to be both a sannyasi and a grihastha at the same time, all you'd be doing was creating a disturbance, and you wouldn't do either very well. You would just do neither well. Does that make sense?
It does, it does.
Because the dharma is contradictory.
I know grihasthas who, not exactly grihasthas, but not exactly brahmachari or sannyasi, somewhere in between.
And usually everybody's unhappy.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, it doesn't work. But, yeah, it's the same with the varnas. You'll do neither well, and you'll just mess it up. Now, there are people who are in one varna particularly assisting another varna. So there are brahmanas who particularly instruct kshatriyas and train the kshatriyas. There are brahmanas who particularly train the shudras. There are kshatriyas who particularly oversee the vaishyas and agriculture. Like you have your Ministry of Agriculture in the government. You have your kshatriyas who particularly help the brahmanas. You have your Ministry of Education. Right? There are shudras who particularly, well, I want to be an admin assistant in a law firm. You have your shudras who really want to assist government. So you do have that kind of a situation, but they're still just doing their own work. And you also had a question? Anyone who wants to leave, you can leave because we are over time. Yes.
My question was about charity, because some devotees think that if they give everything to Krishna, they don't need to give it to someone else.
Oh, if I give everything to Krishna, I don't need to give anything to someone else. But Krishna himself says in the 18th chapter that charity, austerity, right? And what else? Penance. No, austerity, penance, same things. Sacrifice, yajna. Yajna, dana, and tapa are for everyone, even the great souls. It purifies them. So everyone should give in charity. I give the example, if you offer food to Krishna, that's not charity. That's yajna. You haven't fulfilled your charity by giving things to Krishna. Krishna is not an object of charity, unless he comes as Vamadeva and you don't know he's Krishna. When you take the food you've offered to Krishna and you distribute it to other people, that's charity. Everyone should give in charity. Prabhupada told Yamuna, he said, if you don't teach others cooking, you'll become envious. Envy is the opposite of charitableness. So envy is, okay, I'm a really good cook, but I don't want anyone to be as good of a cook as I am. Or to become better, but not even as good. I mean, that's kind of the root of envy. Like, you can have a nice car as long as my car is nicer. You can have an attractive spouse as long as my spouse is more attractive. You can have a smart kid as long as my kid is smarter. And charity is the opposite of that. That you want to give, you want to share. That is part of our service to Krishna. It's not a separate thing. If I've really dedicated myself to Krishna, then Krishna is the one who's telling me to be charitable. That's his instruction, to be charitable. And we should be charitable with our money. We should be charitable with our time. We should give. The whole universe, the Lord himself, is pleased with those who give. It's the essence of Dharma, is to serve, to give. So it's not a dichotomy. It's not, I just serve Krishna, and therefore I don't have to give anything. If I'm serving Krishna, I will be giving. Because that's what Krishna wants me to do. He wants me to be a giver. He doesn't want me to be selfish. He doesn't want me to be a taker. Right? We have these stories in the, was that Avanti Brahmana, who was a miser? He didn't even want to give to his family, and he was condemned for this. So just thinking about myself it's condemned. I mean, Prahlad Maharaj said, I don't want to be like these people who just go off to, you know, along by themselves and just take care of their own spiritual life. I want to help everyone. This is the mood of Lord Brahma. He says, I'm simply concerned with everyone. How can I purify everyone? How can I help everyone? And there's no compassion. Without charity, there's no compassion. There's just selfishness. Does that make sense?
I was remembering also in the Bhagavad Gita 3:20, it says, whatever you give in charity, give it to me.
Do it as an offering to me. Yes. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer and give away, do all that as an offering to me. Okay, whatever you eat. Does that mean you don't eat? David Rajaswami likes to tell the story when he first read about Prabhupada says we take the remnants. He couldn't understand what that meant. He thought it meant you take whatever stuck to the bottom of the pot and you eat that and you throw everything else away. He couldn't make heads or tails out of it. I offer to Krishna and then I eat it. Whatever charity I'm giving should be done for the glory of Krishna, to please Krishna. Whatever I do should be done for the glory of Krishna, to please Krishna. Everything I do should be done to serve him. Charity and tamagun, I give to the wrong person. I give the wrong thing to the wrong person. Or I give the right thing to the right person, but at the wrong time. I wake them up at 1 a.m. to give it to them. Or while they're taking a shower. Or I give it without respect. Take your charity, Maharaj, get out of my face. That's tamagun charity. Rajagun charity is I'm calculating. I'm giving something, but I'm thinking, if I give this, maybe I'll get a raise at work. Or maybe then I'll get this facility, or people will respect me. Or you're giving because someone asked you to, and you're like, I don't really want to give, but, you know, my boss, my guru's on my case, I should give this. Or giving it with regret. Why did I give all that time and energy? And giving in sattvagun, you're giving the right thing to the right person with respect, at the right time, the right place, so you can feel, I'm a good person. I do the right thing. I'm a giver. And in bhakti, you're giving so Krishna can be happy. Krishna wants me to share my food with others. Krishna wants me to share my money with others. Krishna wants me to share my time with others. All the gifts that Krishna's given me, Krishna hasn't just given me all these gifts for me to enjoy. Even as prasadam, I'm meant to share them. It's like yesterday somebody saved me a maha plate and there was some kandvi, which I really like, but there was just one piece. And my friend Chidi Shakti came and we bought some stuff from the cafe and we were sitting down and I said, is it all right if I eat the whole kandvi? She said, yeah, sure. And then I'm like, nah, Krishna's not going to be happy with me for that. There's only one piece. If I eat it all myself, he's not going to be happy. So I gave her part of it. I didn't want to give her part of it, honestly. I was like, I wanted to eat the whole thing. But I'm like, you know, my boss is going to be mad at me. He wants me to share. He doesn't want me to be greedy. He doesn't want me to be selfish. He doesn't want me to be a miser. He wants me to share. So whatever you have, share it. Is that all right? To please Krishna, not so you're like, I'm a very good person, or not so you'll get good karma, or not to just get people off your case.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Ask another question about charity.
Okay.
So the next question is then much, because most people will think they don't have enough to give in charity. Like if I give to somebody else, then maybe, you know, I won't be able to buy nice food for my deities or, you know, clothe
yes.
them nicely. And there's like different things I've heard, like a brahmana should give away everything and he doesn't stock anything even for the next day.
Although that's not very practical in 2025.
Yeah, so that's what I'm asking.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not very practical.
Rupa Goswami's 50%, you know.
Yeah, of course he gave 50% when he retired. Prabhupada says to use 50% of our energy in somehow in the mission. If you can't do that with 50% of your gross income, I mean, there was a long time as grahasthas that we were giving 50% of our gross income in various ways, like sometimes even using half of our house or three quarters of our house for a gurukul and things like that. So in our book Career Dharma, we talk about the fact that most people will never think they have enough. You know, that even someone who has 50 million pounds in the bank may think, well, I'm not yet financially secure enough. So give something. I mean, the way I was raised is my mother always taught me, don't give so much in charity that you have to become an object of charity. Like, don't impoverish yourself to the point that then other people have to maintain you because you're living on the street. But we have Ranti Dev who did that. We have Ranti Dev who actually gave everything so that he was going to die. But that shouldn't be imitated. So something, I mean, what a lot of people do is they make a commitment in advance. I'm going to give some percentage of my wealth. And then whatever they earn, they give that percentage. And then they adjust their lifestyle accordingly. Does that make sense? Like, I get this much, I'm going to give a certain percentage of whatever I get, and I'm going to adjust my lifestyle accordingly. There are many extremely rich people who've made a vow of giving away 99%. They've made this what's called a giving pledge. But charity also isn't just money. Prabhupada told Yamuna, teach other people how to cook. Charity is your time. Your time is money, right? Yes? Where do you get money from unless you got an inheritance? You got money from working, from time. If you're getting paid, you know, whatever, 50 pounds an hour, that 50 pounds represents an hour of your time. Well, if you don't have 50 pounds, do you have an hour? Can you volunteer? And then it's good for everyone to do some menial service so those things get done, but also volunteer in your area of talent, in your area of wisdom, in your area of enjoyment. Does that make sense to everybody? Give something that's valuable to you. And we should give something that's valuable to us. Don't just give your old broken car to the temple as a tax write-off. You know, charity actually should sting a little. Does that make sense? I should give something that has some value to me, not just, you know, the leftover things. Some time, some energy, some thought, some care, some knowledge, some money, something that I should develop an atmosphere of giving. Does that work? Share some of your favorite prep with your friend. So thank you very much for your hospitality and your care. No, I really should end now. Oh, it's 5 to 9. What is it? Another question about charity. Mike.
Hare Krishna, sorry. Thank you for wonderful class. But so confusing to layman about so many thoughts. You have the psychological sense where people say, fend for yourself, you know. We should have...
Well, it's a very simple question. Would you rather live in a charitable society or an uncharitable society? Very simple.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Okay, but there's the question about karma as well. If somebody comes with their karma to live in poverty, what's... We all have our karma, yes. Baggages we came with previously. Yes. So if you have, your karma says this is what you are ordained to have in this life.
Do you know what your karma of how much money you have in this life is based on?
No.
Does anyone know? How charitable you were in other lifetimes.
Okay.
So how much you have in this life is based on how much you shared in your other lifetimes. Okay?
That's right.
Okay. Now, there's a lot of evidence, this is empirical evidence, but there's a lot of evidence that if you want to increase your wealth in this lifetime, one way is to be charitable. That people who are charitable in this life get richer in this life.
Okay.
It seems that Krishna really likes this idea of being a sharing person. It seems that it's something that's really, like, important to him. Not to be a greedy, selfish person. Not to be a miser. It seems to be one of his prime interests.
So, when you come with that baggage, okay, you're not aware that you're preparing yourself for the next life.
Of poverty, yeah.
Yes, so should you not live out your karma without having people to hand out? Just wondering, because there's so many thoughts.
Should we just let everybody live out their karma and not help anybody?
That's a question.
Well, is that how you want to be dealt with when something happens to you?
Yes, that's what
people, yes?
What people aren't aware
but
of.
But I'm asking, you know, well, then you just say that to people.
Yeah.
You know? If you come into hard times, and all of us can come into hard times, right? You can be rich one day and penniless the next. Does this happen? You can be able-bodied and the next day be in a wheelchair. Can that happen?
Yeah.
We can all end up in a position where we need people to help us. And we don't want people coming to us and saying, well, that's just your karma. See, what happens is, if you help somebody on a material level, if you help someone in need, you get good karma. If you refuse to help someone in need, you get bad karma. Now, we're not interested in karma or vikarma. We're interested in akarma. We want to help people because Krishna wants us to help people. Even if we're not successful at helping them, at least we want to try. Because Krishna wants us to help people and not hurt people. We're not in charge of the results of our action, but we at least try. That's not our problem. That's between them and God. If I try to help people who don't appreciate it or don't use it, that's between them and God. Now, if I find that someone regularly does that, then let me give help where it's going to be efficacious. Like Jesus said, don't throw your pearls before swine. So if you see that people are... I mean, Brihaspati, it was Durvasa. Durvasa Muni got fried with Indra because he gave Indra a garland, and Indra gave it to his elephant who trampled it. So if you see that people are taking the good that you give to them and they're misusing it and they're neglecting it and then they're ungrateful, then you say this is not a proper... Because part of charity is giving the right thing to the right people. And part of the right people is knowing, are people going to actually appreciate it and use it? In fact, it's an offense to give people something higher than they're able to use in terms of like knowledge, like to give the glories to a faithless person. So it's actually, then you start getting into tamagun charity, where you're giving in charity to people who can't accept it and won't accept it. So then you say, that's not the place to do it. That's not what I'm going to give. Is that all right? Okay, I really need to end here. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.